I will talk on solitary wave dynamics in an external potential, and we will consider the focusing nonlinear Schrödinger equation. And we have a potential V, and we add some focusing nonlinearity F. I will give you details on how F looks like in a while. And we have an initial condition, psi naught in H1. This is a joint work with Michael Siegel, Jürg Fröhlich, and Stephen Gustafson. And it's published as, well, it's accepted for publication in CNP. All right, let's see what we can cover. I want you to have a picture of a potential in D dimensions. And the potential should vary slowly, and it should vary slowly on the scale of a soliton. But a soliton here would be a small dot on this potential. And I will come back to this picture several times. So this is our equation, and we have a given potential. Applications to this is in quantum field theory, nonlinear optics, and several others that I'm sure you know of. So let's continue. We'd like to introduce the concept of solitary waves. Just to be very clear about what we mean with it. We start with setting the potential identically equal to zero. It's known that the generalized nonlinear Schrödinger equation have solitary waves. And with that, we mean the class of solutions of the form psi solitary. It depends on position and of a number of parameters, which in turn depends on time. Parameters A, B, gamma, and mu satisfy the following ordinary differential equation. And the solitary wave profile eta is the solution to the nonlinear eigenvalue problem. Of course, for it to have a solution that is positive, spherically symmetric, we need some requirement on F. But I would like to defer that a little bit more. So such solutions, psi, I would like to call solitary waves. Okay. Properties of eta is that it's positive, and it's spherically symmetric, and typically have the form decaying with the parameter mu. I will define a manifold of solitary waves as the set of such solutions depending on x, a, v, gamma, and mu, such that so this is points in an H1 space. They don't depend on time, but those solitary wave solutions will trace out lines on this manifold. So we are interested in the case when we here, the potential is non-zero, and we expect to modify the modulation equations to take into account the non-zero V. But we still somehow expect that the solitary waves will tell us something important about the solution to this set of equations. And we will treat this essentially as a perturbation argument. And to do that, we need to introduce length scales. So there are two major length scales in this problem. The first one is the length scale of the potential. And we measure how rapidly the potential varies by the gradient of the potential. It's a measurement of how slowly this one is varying. The other length scale is of the solitary wave. And solitary waves are scaled or are determined in size by the parameter mu. So that's the second length scale. But that length scale is not obviously appearing in this equation. And how is it related to this mu or this soliton? And it is related because we are going to determine, we are going to study this only for psi naught initial conditions that are close to one of the soliton. And that soliton it's close to introduce our length scale. So we can only consider certain initial conditions. And we will stay in the regime such that the soliton here is small on the size of the change of the potential. And to express this in the terms of those two length scale, we have that the supremum of the gradient V over the square root of mu should be a small parameter epsilon V, which we require to be much less than one. And for this talk, I will simplify by fixing mu to be of size 1. So we consider initial conditions, which are close to solitons with the frequency 1. And it implies, I will imply in this talk that the multi-index parameter derivative of the potential should be less than some constant epsilon V for all alpha less or equal than 2. So we require that it's a bounded function and that its first and second derivative remain small, or that we can make them small enough. Of course, we also require that C is twice differentiable function that takes, that gives real valued values. So this is our assumptions for the potential. Yes? Yes, exactly. So the small v here is the velocity. I haven't told you what the non-linearity is. I will give you a list of conditions implicitly on requirements on the non-linearity for which this works. So the first such assumption is that there is a primitive function f, large f. The energy and symmetry assumption. So we assume that there exists an f such that its derivative, Fréchelier derivative or its variational derivative, depending in which space you're looking on this, I will write both of them with f prime, should be equal to our nonlinearity. This is always true in the local case. It's not always true if we have a non-local nonlinearity. But we require it. The second assumption is we don't want the nonlinearity to break any additional symmetries of our given problem. So let S be one of the symmetries translation or rotation. Or the phase or the boost or the complex conjugate. If S is any one of those symmetries, then we want that this large F should be invariant under it. That is, the second assumption is that then we have the list of normal assumptions. We require global well-posedness for H1 data. We require existence of solitons. Of course, positive and spherically symmetric. We require orbital stability. So that includes the V. And the orbital stability, we can express it as d mu of the L2 norm should be positive. And in addition to those conditions, we will also need a technical condition. In particular, when F here is non-local, we will need a requirement on a null space of a Hessian. We'll come back to that if I have time. So an example of a nonlinearity that satisfies this is a local nonlinearity plus, say, a Hartree type nonlinearity. We require that W satisfies certain conditions depending on the dimension belonging in to some LQ spaces, and G here could be a sum of powers. Where sigma 1 and sigma 2 have to be subcritical. So, given this list of assumptions, I can state the theorem. So we are given two small numbers, epsilon naught and epsilon b, both positive. And we introduce the new notation epsilon as the sum of those. We require that both of them are sufficiently small compared to one. In addition to that, we have the assumptions on the potential and the nonlinearity. Now we would like to have a condition that psi naught should be close to one of the solitons in this manifold of solitons. So we are trying to compare psi naught with f of mu in H1. But we have a whole set of possible VA gamma that we could vary. So of course we can move it along to any one of those solitary waves. So let's do that. We can translate this initial condition, distance a naught, and we can correct its phase so that it's stationary. And this is really only measuring that psi naught should be close to the manifold of solitons. And it should be sufficiently close, such as epsilon naught, the distance between them are very small. And we have, of course, to find those constants, that point on the manifold to which this one is close. So for some if we have all of this, then we can say something. The first thing we can say is there exists a constant large T such that for times T smaller or equal to T over epsilon naught squared plus epsilon V. So for long times, because epsilon here, both of them are very small numbers, the soliton under the solution of the generalized inertia equation is of a certain form. So we have that it is a soliton or a solitary wave. That's the solitary wave part. And we have a perturbation. Like that. So we can write the solution to the generalized nonlinear Schrödinger equation as something that involves on this manifold plus a perturbation. But now I can also give you how the parameters change. That's the second part. We can also say the size of this perturbation for this time interval. The size is that the H1 norm of the perturbation is smaller or equal to epsilon, which was the sum of epsilon naught and epsilon v for some constant. The second part was the modulation equations, how they have changed. So the velocity of the center of mass of our solitary wave or the solution . The position of the center A hasn't changed anything, and then the phase, first we have the two terms that was here before, but we also have to correct it with respect to the potential. And during the time that we consider, the size of the solitary wave doesn't change. Notice that the first two of them describes Newton's equation for a particle in a well. So that means that in this case, the solitary wave, if it's stationary here, would start to glide down in this downhill. There are a few things I would like to point out about this theorem. The first thing, there is an asymmetry here. The initial condition, we can take T over epsilon naught raised to the square. We'd really like to have epsilon V raised to the square too, but we can't reach it yet, at least not for just bounded potentials. And the second part is, we have a very good description of how the solitary wave evolves. We know that it's a soliton. This is exactly what we expect. And what if the potential hadn't existed, then the W should eventually radiate away, and this would be a result. When we have a potential here, this is not clear that this will be the case. We could possibly trap part of the W. But so far, that is not clear. I would like to mention some of the long list of people who have done things on which we base our results. So global well-postedness by Ginevra and Velo, existence of soliton by Beresteke and Lyons. We have orbital stability by Weinstein, 1985 and 86. We have asymptotic stability by Soffer and Weinstein, Buslev and Perlman, Kukanya, Buslev and Sulen, Rodniansky, Schlag and Soffer. And then on the dynamics, we have both Bronsky and Girard, Frölich, Tsai and Yao, and S. Kirani of 2002. So there are several people who have worked in this direction. But, yeah. All right. On the remaining 10 minutes, I will try to tell you a few things more. Among other things, I would like to outline ideas underlying the proof of this. So, we are given a decomposition, and we can show that this decomposition has a small perturbation part. So, ingredients that have to go into this is we have to somehow decompose psi into the W and the finite dimensional part. That decomposition has to be according to the flow of the solution. So we can't decompose psi into orthogonal and non-orthogonal parts to this manifold. We have to decompose it with respect to the complex structure of the Hamiltonian system. Once we have done that, we will apply energy estimates on the infinite dimensional part, and we will estimate the remaining part of the finite dimensional part of the solution. So now I have a choice, and as Walter Craig always does, he usually takes a vote. I can go through and try to prove this, or I could show a small graph of the result. That's the choice. Everybody who wants to see an idea of the proof on 7.5 minutes, hand up, please. And, okay, I think that told it. Okay, if there are abstentions, how many want to see the graph? there are a little bit more people who wants to see the graph. Let's do that. All right. Thank you. So if we now have done this decomposition, Busleben, Perlman and Busleben, Sulem's work shows that we expect that the perturbation should radiate away without the potential. The question is, can we see anything such? So I did small numerical calculation. I took epsilon to a very large number because I wanted to perturb the system. I took epsilon to 0.4. And I plot, I took a potential part of an exponential, very flat at the bottom. I place my soliton in one dimension, integrable case, stationary starting at this point. What you see on the graph is the center of mass oscillating back and forth. That's the cross on this very dirty overview graph. The other, the circles, are the nonlinear Schrödinger equation solved in full. And solving this numerically, we have to have conserved quantities. And the mass or number of particles have varied by 7 times 10 raised to minus 5. And the energy has changed by 0.3%. And during this long time, 300 seconds, we can't see any, we can't distinguish between the conserved particle going back and forth in the well and the nonlinear Schrödinger equation, which could have radiation. So what this tells me is that the radiation part is going to be very, very small. One will have to do very good codes in order to see any part of the radiation. In particular, one has to do better boundary conditions than I have been able to have. All right. Thanks for me.